This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 72, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. Our mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And every Thursday I release an episode called Paranormal Stories, and that has UFO cases as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, which is an extra 30 minutes, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign, where there are now over 70 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Gary Heseltine about his book, Non-Human, The Rendlesham Forest UFO Incidents, 42 Years of Denial. Gary is the founder and editor of UFO Truth magazine and is based in the UK. He spent 6 years in the Royal Air Force Police before joining the British Transport Police. He went on to complete an almost 24-year career before retiring in early 2013 to follow his passion for researching UFOs. In 2010, he was awarded the PRG Disclosure Award in Washington, D.C. for his work with police officers. And in 2012, he was presented with the ExoPolitics Great Britain Award for his research. He then appeared at the prestigious 2013 Citizens Hearings at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., speaking on behalf of police officers worldwide. As one of 9 researchers, he gave testimony before the Brazilian Senate in June 2022. Gary is also Vice President of ICER, that's the International Coalition for Extraterrestrial Research. Hi, Gary, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Simon, for inviting me on.
So we're going to be talking about your book. It's called Non-Human, The Rendlesham Forest UFO Incidents, 42 Years of Denial. But first of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about your background, because you've interviewed a lot of the people that are in the book, and your background as a detective means that you're a professional interviewer and you can spot if people are lying or a bit evasive. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, I in the police, I became an advanced interviewer of suspects and witnesses, 2 different training courses, but effectively you are taught psychological techniques, not only to retrieve information, I say, with witnesses, but also with suspects. Is you're trained psychologically to monitor nonverbal communications, the way the body moves when people react or if they're being deceptive, etc. So, yeah, you learn some techniques. They're not absolute. There is no absolute guarantee that you can detect a liar. But I think if you're an intuitive interviewer, a natural interviewer, like which I think I was, it was something I always enjoyed doing. I didn't want to go higher. I was a detective constable. I didn't want to go higher rank, because if you went higher rank, it meant most of the time you sat behind a desk, whereas I like to the psychology of sitting down with, you know, with rapists and people like that and robbers and whatever and trying to psych them out and understand their perspective and obviously try to gain admissions if there were suspects. And if it was like on a major incident for a murder or something like that, then you could use specialist interviewing skills to gather more information than somebody who is not trained would get, because there's different memory tools that you can use that you're taught that can unlock hidden memories. It's not hypnosis, it's all conscious retrieval, but it's just the way you approach and set up witnesses in particular. And the technique that I use, what was called the enhanced cognitive method, was invented 20, 30 years ago. And it was based on psychology, on how people react to questioning about extreme events and how to trigger memories, to recall memories. And it's designed to be used within literally hours of a major incident to try to get the pristine memories while they're sharp in your mind. Well, this is impossible to do when you talk to Rendlesham witnesses. However, I've always been one that thought, well, if you adapt part of it, you can try to work with somebody even all these years later. And in particular, it worked really well with 2 military witnesses some of whom have already been interviewed many years ago, and one fairly recently. Steve Longero was an airman. He'd already done an interview, a fairly brief interview that was in the national papers with Philip Mantle. With him, when I read the account in the newspaper, just the way Longero responded to some of the questions, I just had a hunch that he knew more. And so obviously I then contacted Philip and asked for Steve's contact details, and he gave me them. And I contacted him and talked to him, and we ended up having like a three and a half hour transatlantic phone call interview. And I gleaned a lot more information that had been in the original Philip Mantle interview. So that was proved, a partial success. But the real big difference with the technique, which, you know, went really well, was with a military witness called Sergeant Adrian Bastinza. Now, Adrian Bastinza is arguably one of the most important military witnesses in the entire RFI. And I say that for a number of reasons, principally because he links his testimony that was taken over a 4.5 hour transatlantic call, basically links him to a second landing, which happened in a field, and it was witnessed by military officers, senior military base commander Colonel Williams. He said that Colonel Holt was there, Lieutenant Colonel Holt at the time, and he said that there were other security, US Air Force security police officers surrounding this larger craft from the first one that you associate with Jim Pennison and John Burroughs. And most interestingly, he said that it was being filmed on cameras. Now, when I spoke to Adrian Bastinza, who has been over the years an extremely reluctant witness, because he didn't like all the infighting that's played out over the years and the witnesses being attacked and whatever. But I finally did speak to him, and on two occasions I had interviews with him, the first a 4.5 hour transatlantic phone call, and then a couple of weeks later I had then a Skype video chat with him for about 75 minutes, and both riveting, and it was a real privilege to speak to him. But in the first one, he did corroborate that he'd been involved in what turns out to be another night of UFO activity. Some people had speculated over the years, as I had, that there may have been more than three consecutive nights of UFO activity in Rendlesham Forest. And he, surprisingly, I had no knowledge what he was going to say. He said basically this other landing happened on a second night that he was involved in UFO activity, and up to that point we only thought it was one night, and then suddenly he's telling me it's another night, and the other night is the second landing, and in it he clears up the mystery and all the arguments about the Larry Warren controversial account that first appeared in the early 80s when he first became prominent. Anthony basically corroborated everything Warren had said, and said Warren was there, he was actually closer to the craft, but it was another night, and that was the significant thing. It wasn't the Holt night, which everybody was thinking it was, and people like John Burroughs would say, well, I don't remember that kind of thing, and now we know why, because it was another night that Adrian Bastinza had been involved in, and so it clears that up, and that was a huge surprise. I had no idea it was coming. And his recall of the actual event and it being filmed and Colonel Williams being there, lots of other security police officers, Larry Warren being there, is very detailed. And you know, we can come back to Adrian Bastinza because you might have him in your questions, but the biggest chapter in the book is devoted to him because of the length of that interview. And I don't transcribe all of it, but I take out the most salient parts, and I tried this enhanced cognitive method, and I was able to retrieve, or he was able to retrieve, a lot more information than he'd ever given before, and especially in the areas post the events he was involved in, where he was being interrogated, threatened with his life. And when you read them in the book, and I think you read the book, his testimony, which is like uninterrupted, is very palpable, and it's very moving. And when I was in the process of proofing the book, what I tend to do, because I'm the editor reviewer for All Truth magazine, is when articles come in and they're ready for the magazine to go out, one of the final things I do is I read out aloud. Everybody's probably got a different technique, but my technique is I read out all the articles in their finished format, just in case there's something that doesn't read right, or there's a typo error or something like that, or you've missed something out and you've cut and pasted something. When I read back the transcript I'd made of Adrian Bustinza talking about his interrogation, I did it kind of actor, with emphasis and intonation. And when I read it back, I thought, "Wow, this is incredibly powerful testimony." And it's a big part of the Reynolds from Forest story, in what I would call in the aftermath, that's not really being told. Yes, we've seen in documentaries people like Jim Penston, Warren, saying they were subjected to harsh interrogations by a number of agents, but most notably probably the Air Force Office of Special Investigation, the plainclothes US Air Force Police, I guess. And we were aware of that, and there's been some recreations, but I don't think any of them have ever captured the sheer sense of terror that some of these people felt. And Adrian Bustinza in particular was a sergeant at the time, and he was so kind of shocked by his treatment, and his life was threatened, bullets are cheap and that kind of thing, and his family were being surveilled in the States. There was a vehicle outside his home. His father worked for the government. There was pressure being put on him from his family because of his father. It was a very difficult scenario, and when you hear him, and it was audio recorded, the interview, but when you read it back in the book, I think it's one of the most powerful sequences in the entire book, because you realise how serious it affected him. And he said he was indignant that he was being treated like this. He joined the US Air Force to, in the good faith of, trying to uphold law and order and defend his country. And there he was being treated like a criminal, threatened with his life just because he got mixed up in something he probably shouldn't have seen. It was so traumatic for him that he at one point wanted to go AWOL, which is absent without leave, i.e. run away, desert, in layman's terms. So that shows you how extreme the interrogations were. And I don't think that's ever really been emphasized enough by the media in the documentaries and books. And so that's another part I think hopefully will get more scrutiny as a result of the book. I mean, the book really was just trying to use my detective skills. I was a detective for 19 years. I was qualified to work on murder, manslaughter, and rape, serious crimes, it's called, in the UK. And when I stepped back and I'd taken some advice from people, and it took me 6 months to realise how I would best approach writing what is arguably the most complicated UFO case in history. So once I decided to write a book, which was about 3 years ago, because I had so much material that I discovered, I spent about 6 months, which sounds a bit daft really, but I really did have to think about how am I going to lay out this information, and there'd been so much disinformation, so much infighting. But in the end, I used, I think, what's turned out to be a good approach, which was step back, take out all emotion, all any bias, and then just look at the facts and go into old interviews, transcribe them, evaluate them as a detective would. What were the key points that came out? And I do that and build that up over time. Then I'd done a number of re-interviews. I'd spoken to a couple of new witnesses, etc. So it all built up, and if you look at the book, it's in three parts, and that was important because there was really the period pre-2017 before I got involved in a reinvestigation. And then I went into the new, what I would say, test me that from the historical and new information that I gathered that I think you, the public, should know. And you've not been told. You've not been told this stuff in documentaries. And there's been over 50 or 60 English-speaking documentaries over the decades. And none of them really addressed the issues that I brought up in the key middle part of the book, which is the witness testimony. And then the third part was really kind of an aftermath, post-investigation, look at various aspects and then end up on with conclusions. So I think that approach worked in the end. And the book took 3 years. The reinvestigation was 5 years. And it was about 3 years ago that my then wife said, well, why don't you write a book? I'd been involved in a documentary called Cape of Green, which is still in post-production, that went from what was going to be a year's intended project to now nearly 6 years down the line, and it's due out, I believe, in September or so of this year. But I never realised it was going to take as long as that. And when I did a deep delve into what I thought, I already thought I knew a lot about Rendlesham because I'd been doing research for a long time, doing public research into the case since December 2007. I thought I knew most of it, but when I actually decided to do a reinvestigation, I literally thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I really have to be accurate. So I literally went to searching for anything post the incident, right from literally day one after the incident, and found loads of, I didn't know, lots of little old interviews being taken by researchers over the years that basically nobody other than the most ardent UFO researcher and author would know. But I would think the vast majority of people didn't even know that, you know, researchers didn't know this stuff. I didn't know this stuff. So I'm sure that a lot of others didn't. And there were some really early riveting interviews that I thought told a story that, in a sense, to the public, you'd never been told. Yes, there might have been broadcast in a little UFO publication over the years. You know, people tended to do online, produce little booklets and things over the years. But we're talking a lot of stuff that had basically been forgotten about. And when I delved deep into the earliest stuff, I was surprised by some of the things that people had been said, and it didn't really compare with what they were saying many years later, etc. So that's the kind of approach. But in the end, it was just about telling the facts, and I think that has worked well. And I think the first thing that I say in the book, Trey Gowdy, who was a former Republican senator, well, forget about politics, but I loved what he said in this quote. And he said, I have no friends to reward and no foes to punish. We're going to go wherever the facts take us. Facts are neither Republican nor Democratic. They are the facts. And I thought, what a brilliant way to approach it. Just take that as my mantra, as it were. The facts are the facts. The evidence falls where it falls, and I just simply evaluate the material and interviews and historical documents that I found, etc., and present them to you as an audience, because I think that you have not been told the whole story. And you know, you tell me. I think you've read the book. What were your thoughts on the book?
Well, it's that thing of, like you said, about yourself. Because I've been into UFOs for so many years, I thought I knew what the Rendlesham Forest incident was about, basically. I thought I'd learned all that stuff, but there's so much more in your book that I didn't know about. And I wanted to ask you about a couple of the people that I've never heard of before. If you just talk about what happened to, is it Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin?
Yeah, it's one of the major revelations that come out in the book. Now, think of it pre-2000, before I start the reinvestigation, I'd been aware, as other people had, that Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin was a young black female officer, very popular apparently on shift, and something had happened to her that had so distressed her that she had to be relieved from duty. And that's pretty much all we knew. Nothing was set in stone. No, there was no hard facts around it. Well, in speaking to one of the military witnesses who'd been involved in what's called one of three precursor cases, which are important UFO cases with military witnesses at Bentworth and Woodbridge that occurred in the run-up. So one had occurred in February 1980, another in July 1980, and then another one in November 1980. Now, people aren't aware of this, and then when you go back to the skeptics who still talk about lighthouses and documentary makers who still highlight the lighthouse, it was always a ridiculous explanation when you actually looked at the facts and the testimony. But unfortunately, we go then into the way the media have conducted themselves. And in reality, the media have done an appalling job of reporting accurately on the Rendlesham Forest story. And I'm quite critical of them in the book. But, you know, there is when we talk about people, there are people who've not had a voice. And that's one of the things I wanted to do.
And was it Bonnie Tamplin? She was so scared by what was happening. Her Jeep rolled over, didn't it? And she started shooting.
Yeah, well, this is the story that emerged. Michael Stacey Smith, who'd had this one of the precursor cases, when I'd spoken to him, he made a... And I interviewed him a number of times, and he made a comment, like a throwaway comment about Bonnie Tamplin. And when I explored it, it turns out that he'd been actually involved in the night that this event took place to Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin. And it's a real incredible story. And basically what happened was, from his point of view, and this is crucial new testimony because it fills in the blanks that we didn't have, is that he was, on the night this occurred, he was on RAF Bentwaters with the rest of his RAF police, US Air Force police, security police colleagues. And he was then told to suddenly go to what was called the back gate of RAF Bentwaters, which was called the Butley Gate. And basically, it wasn't the main entrance. It was back gate onto a little rural back road that would eventually take you to RAF Woodbridge, approximately 3-4 miles away, on country roads, basically. And now, what had happened to set this up was that there was a female airman, and that sounds a contradiction in terms, but I put in the book Air Woman, and I was actually contradicted by one of the people, a female, and she says, no, even though I'm a woman, they're still called as airmen, which I guess was a different time in history. But yes, Airman Laurie Bowen, a female, was at the East Gate, and she saw a red glowing object drop into the forest, descend into the forest. And she used her telephone at the gate to contact Central Security Control and explain what had happened. And it just so happened that Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin was in a military vehicle and had just left by the back gate, I think, RAF Bentwaters, en route to RAF Woodbridge. And basically the forest is in the middle, if you think of it in simplistic terms. So she's on a rural road driving towards RAF Woodbridge when she hears over the radio that, and probably from Central Security Control, that Laurie Bowen has seen something drop into the forest. Well, as she was the nearest person, she's obviously gone on to the radio and say, I'll attend to that. And she's on her own and she is off driving towards it. And so, like, let's now go back to Michael Stacey Smith. Michael Stacey Smith is told to suddenly, it was a real rush on. This is not just, oh, can you just open this gate? This was an urgency. Open up that gate, the back gate. So he goes down. He doesn't know why. He's at the back gate of RAF Bentwaters, called the Butley Gate. Then suddenly he's opened it up, and suddenly 3 or 4 vehicles in a convoy, all US Air Force Spirit Police vehicles, suddenly approach, in a sense, in convoy, at speed. He lets them out and he's thinking, what's going on? Off they go onto the public roads towards RAF Woodbridge. Then A few minutes later, he sees Larry Tamplin. So this is first-person direct testimony. It's not hearsay. First-person direct witness testimony. He sees her being in the front passenger seat with Sergeant Robert Ball, who's responded to her first, following her distress cries over the radio, help, help, help. So something had happened to her. We didn't know what. The convoy goes out, and a few minutes later, Robert Ball brings her back in a military vehicle. She's the front seat passenger, and she is not wearing a beret. She's disheveled. She's a quivering wreck, in simple terms. Something really awful has happened to her. He doesn't know what. In she goes in through the gate, and he stays there. And then a few minutes later, he then sees what turns out to be Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin's military vehicle. And it's been driven by someone else, part of that convoy that had gone out there, to retrieve what turns out to be a vehicle that had sustained some damage to the roof, as if it had rolled, had been involved in an accident, and had sustained some damage to the vehicle. And it's still drivable, and it comes in. Now, he's thinking, what the hell's going on here? In a sense, he's a direct witness to two aspects. One, he sees the aftermath of the event and sees the physical effect, the demeanour of Lieutenant Bonnie Tamplin as she comes back, having picked up. And then he can also confirm that the vehicle she'd been driving had sustained vehicle damage consistent with having been rolled, gone onto its side, etc. So that's his first person testimony. Now, he didn't know the other part, what had actually happened to her. But after the gate is closed and she's gone back onto the base, he then speaks to a sergeant who he was good friends with. And the sergeant says, if I tell you what happened to her, you must never give my name to anyone. And he promised him he wouldn't, and he didn't, and he upheld that. He didn't tell me. But I have no reason to disbelieve what Michael Stacey Smith, and yes, it's hearsay, but this is from, in a sense, the horse's mouth, somebody who dealt with the aftermath of Bonnie Tamplin going back to the police building. And the story that emerged was, as she'd been driving on the public road, on a rural British country road, suddenly, a red glowing object, spherical, maybe bigger than a beach ball, maybe the size of a car, is travelling alongside of her at hedgerow height. So you're driving on a little rural country lane, and then suddenly this UFO, whatever you want to call it, object, is travelling alongside, keeping pace with her vehicle. Well, I think anybody would be frightened under those circumstances. And because we're talking narrow country roads, she was obviously distracted enough to lose control of the vehicle. And what had happened was she'd end up going into a ditch and rolling the vehicle. Well, here's the part that gets even more interesting, is that when she's rolled the vehicle, she clambers out. And there, when she gets out, she sees this same object hovering close by. I mean, within feet of her, basically just looking down at her. Now, can you imagine that? If you put yourself in her position, she's absolutely terrified, and why wouldn't you be? And then she picks up her M16 and she begins shooting at this thing, which then makes the object move away at speed and disappear. Absolutely terrified by what she'd encountered. And so that was the story. But the wider story is that you've never heard of this, like I'd never heard of this. And this is the story that's told in the book for the first time. Is this missing piece of information. We knew something had happened. Lieutenant Colonel Holt, then Colonel Holt in retirement, said that he was aware that something extreme had happened to him, but he said he didn't know the story, and he said that she quickly got shipped back to the States. Well, that apparently is all true. Within days, she's shipped back to the States, and that's when the story goes stale, because we don't really know what happens to her militarily after that. But this whole story is then effectively covered up. And the sergeant said, yes, she did discharge a firearm, this M16, and the bullets that she discharged were put back so that there was no discrepancy in the records. And basically, it's, you think about this, on a public road, a lieutenant, an officer, is run off the road by a UFO, and she is so terrified that she ends up shooting at it, and she is so traumatized by this event that she doesn't go back on shift, and within days is flown back to the United States. What a story. And all of it was covered up by the United States Air Force, and I've no doubt that the approval of the US government. So that's an insensational story. And I've no reason to disbelieve Michael Stacy Smith. He was an honorable man, served in the military with credit. There was absolutely no stain against him. Why should he lie and make this up? And he was very kind of reluctant to talk about it because they'd all taken oaths and were all told not to talk about things. And so they took that very seriously. But with confidence, gathering confidence and other people coming forward, he did choose to speak out to me. But again, if it wasn't for an off-chance remark that he said, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. But sometimes you just get a little nugget and you think, really? Oh, I'll go back to that. And I did, and it resulted in that what is an amazing account.
And also there's James Stewart's encounter while he was working on an aircraft.
Well, there is. Now, James, entirely new witness, but there is a twist to this story post-publication of the book. This, his account is exactly the same, but I think maybe just a week or 10 days after the book had been published on Amazon, so we're talking mid-February, he rings me up. He sends me a message and says, I've been checking my personnel records, evaluation records that you get each year for your work. And he said, I thought my incident, because of all the other incidents we've read about, must have been part of the December 1980 clutch of sightings. He said, but I've checked my records. I had my incident in December of 1979, not late December 1980. So it's not a part of the clutch. So if you went to the conclusions of the book, at the time the book was published, I said there were 18 separate incidents that made up the RFI over three, potentially four successive nights. Well, his case has immediately been taken from that, but it opens up in its way another conundrum, because his account is so bizarre. And again, I've checked his military records. The guy is absolutely a stand-up guy. I've spoken to him on video calls, Zoom, etc. Really, I've seen his medical, his military records. He's a stand-up guy and very believable. Why is he going to make this up? But his account now is a year earlier. Now, there is a kind of a twist to this, because it's still relevant in the story, because if you think of the precursor cases, we had one in February 80, July 80, and then November 80, and then the clutch of sightings around late December. Well, it now then goes into this precursor case, and it's an exceptional precursor case. And if you want me to, I'll tell you about what happened to him.
Yeah, because it is bizarre, and it's almost...
It's like science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically what happened was, we're not talking about a US Air Force security police officer, which is good in a sense, because it broadens this story to not just the police. He was what was called a crew chief, and he was working on repairing a Phantom. Now, there's been some discussion post this release of the book from people who served there and said, well, the Phantoms had gone and it was all A-10s. But according to James Stewart, there were just three F-4 Phantoms left, and they had to be gone by, I think, the end of January 1980. And I've then gone back to some people, queried that, and said, yeah, that's possible. So essentially, it was all A-10s, and all the Phantoms had gone to other bases, but there may have just been two or three that were left. So it's all, to me, plausible. And I know from my time in the Royal Air Force that there were, you know, when I first got to Honington, there were still Buccaneers, two or three of them, three or four Hunter aircraft, older jets, and then it all went to Tornadoes. So there were always one or two that were kept back for whatever reason. So that seems totally plausible to me. Okay, here's his story. And it's a fantastic story. whatever year it is. So basically, he is close to the East Gate. Now, anybody familiar with Rendlesham who's visited or have read books will know that there's quite a lot of activity seen at or near the back gate of RAF Woodbridge, and it's just referred to as the East Gate, equivalent to the Butley Gate at RAF Bentwaters. So he is working on an aircraft, on an F-4 Phantom, and it's night. He's doing it at night. It's illuminated the area, and he's underneath the aircraft. And if you think of, in simple terms, of an aircraft with an undercarriage and it's like bomb doors open, and it's got a ladder up to the cockpit, and he is underneath at the time this event begins. Now, it's at night, and apparently, and this is a quiz, is odd in itself and adds some credence to the story, the back gate at Woodbridge was not routinely manned, for want of a better phrase. There was a little, what's called a guard shack there, just for inclement weather, that they could stand inside, and there was a telephone connection, which is relevant to the later story in December 1980, when, you know, the John Burroughs and Sergeant Bud Steffens see lights in the forest. They go and they use that phone to alert control. That's a year later. But there is this guard shack there, and there is a telephone connection. But the interesting thing was, I'm told by many of the people I've interviewed that it was not routinely guarded, unless they were on some kind of an alert or an exercise. Now, it turns out that in this incident involving James Stewart, there was a security, US Air Force security police officer on it. The question as to why. Okay, so consider that in the background. There is somebody there. Now, that person would be armed, and that plays a part in this story. So he's working approximately 50 meters or so, 50 to 100 meters, shall we say, from the back gate where that security police officer would be. And he's working on the underneath of this F4 Phantom. And apparently it had recently had a new canopy screen, you know, plexi screen fitted for the pilot. He was working underneath. It's the middle of the night. And then suddenly he feels a vibration from above the what he thinks is like on the tail, the spine going down from the back of the cockpit down to the tail of the aircraft. He feels a judder, and he thinks, what's that? It's as if somebody stood on the vehicle, on the aircraft. So he comes out, and at the same time, he goes up to the cockpit ladder, and he starts climbing. And as he's climbing up, or moments before this, he hears what he can only describe as something being stroked. Yes, if something was scratching the cockpit. Didn't know what it was, so he comes out, he climbs up the ladder. He doesn't see anything, but he feels the aircraft judder, the spine of the aircraft judder. And as he climbs up, again, he doesn't see anything, but he sees some kind of footprint along the tail, going to the spine of the plane from the cockpit down to the tail of the aircraft, and indistinct, but in the moisture of the night air, there were some kind of footprints. And then he felt another judder, as if something had jumped down from the tail into the nearby bushes, and there was lots of nearby bushes because it was very close to the perimeter fence. And he obviously looked, and he saw something scurrying through the undergrowth. And anybody that's been to Air Force bases will know that they're always set very close to perimeters and forests and whatever, just basically for cover, camouflage, etc. And so there's lots of undergrowth. And he doesn't see what the actual object is, but something is moving away from him through the bushes towards the perimeter fence. And then something even more bizarre happens. He then hears gunshots being fired from the direction of the East Gate. So he's assuming it's the US Air Force security police officer, doesn't know his name, But basically, somebody begins shooting. So he hit, rightly, as anybody would do, hits the deck from underneath the aircraft for protection. And he then hears the guard, whoever it was, shout something along the lines of, get away, get away. And a couple of more shots fired. I think there were maybe two, and then a pause, and then two more shots. And something else is scurrying through the bushes, not seeing what it was, but something is scurrying away, and it appears to be there are two things, that's all you can describe, because they were never seen, scurrying away in the direction of the forest outside of the perimeter fence. Now, at the time in 1980, the trees were much closer, and it was before the big hurricane, as it were, destroyed most of the original trees in 1987. So there were lots, the layout is different from where it is now. Lots of trees have grown back, but they're not the same trees, and they're not the same height, etc., as they were. So there was a clump of trees near to the east gate, approximately 150 yards, as they would say then, perhaps 175 metres now, from the east gate, where the east gate had originally been, because it changed position slightly. So approximately 150, 175 metres away from the east gate, something towards a clump of trees, and at the same time, these two objects, whatever they are, scurrying through the bushes, they're both going in the same direction, and Airman, the crew chief, the guy who's working on the aircraft, sees a UFO, classic UFO, descending vertically, down, in behind this clump of trees. And this is not more than 150 to 175 metres from the east gate in its original position. Wow, this is entirely new. I've never heard of this. And it comes down, and then it goes out of sight. But these two objects, whatever they were, things were scurrying towards it. So you can only draw an assumption, rightly or wrongly, that these things were heading towards that landing craft, UFO, whatever you want to call it. But that's an incredibly bizarre thing. Now, when the shots are heard, for some reason, it would trigger his boss to suddenly turn up where he was, having heard the shots, and he basically said to him, get in, we thought you'd been abducted. Sounds crazy, it sounds like science fiction, but get in. And I think there's some talk of, we thought you were a fifth person that had been taken. Now, it really does sound like science fiction, but when you hear him tell it, and you check him out as a serviceman, I have no reason to disbelieve him. The fact that it's a fantastic account really is not that fantastic when you then compare it to many of the other accounts that occurred over the Rendlesham Forest incident, i.e. where entities and things like that, people are allegedly abducted. So it's just one of these bizarre events, but it was completely new. And originally he said it was December 1980, but it now turns out when he's checked his records, it was December of 1979. So it just throws up more questions. And interestingly, some people who have been involved in Rendlesham have said it was as if the US Air Force knew something was coming. Now, some people have speculated that that's an exercise and whatever, but I can go into the reasons why I don't think that holds any water later on, just by the number of incidents, the number of different shaped objects that are seen, the entities, etc. It's just we didn't have the technology to get anywhere near doing that. However, some people have said that they thought it was weird. It was as if they anticipated something was coming. Well, if you now think of this now, December 1979, a year later, almost exactly a year later, I think he thought it was 28th of December when his event occurred, 1979. It's literally the same time period a year later when this cluster of what we now know as the RFI, the Rendlesham Forest incident, all occurs. So if you think about it in that way, maybe there's something to this that said maybe they might come back at Christmas 1980. It's just another little take on it. And even though it's not part of the main cluster of late December sightings, I still think it's a very powerful testimony. And you read that. What did you think of the testimony?
Yes, like you say, it sounds like a science fiction film. Just imagine these things scurrying away in the underbrush and you see the bushes shaking, but you don't actually see the creature that's doing it.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of the classic E.T. at the start of the film, the Hollywood film, where he's left behind and he's trying to scurry back to the craft. That's the illusion that it gives. But, of course, we can't prove that. But based on his testimony, something was moving under its own steam and heading into the forest towards where a landed UFO was seen. So it kind of throws up that scenario. And when you put it, like I say, in context with other sightings, which we may or may not talk about in your questions, it's not that different.
And it's weird that they said to him, we thought you might have been abducted. You would have been the fifth person.
Absolutely. I mean, when you hear that, you know, let's put this into context. Based on the reinvestigation, I think that there's at least two occasions in the late December cluster of sightings that indicate missing time, as we would associate it now with the abduction experience kind of scenario. And the first one is well known, which is what you've got is John Burroughs was a definite witness to at least two incidents. And the first one was with Jim, Edgar Manzac, Jim Peniston, John Burroughs, and Edgar Manzac all involved in the forest, which is generally referred to as the first night of activity. Now, interestingly, when I was walking through the forest with Colonel Holt in 2010, I was getting him to retrace his classic audio. And retrace his steps through the forest, and he'd not really done that before. And at the time, my then wife was filming us with his permission, and she was doing intermittent filming. She's not a cameraman at all, but she was just using her iPhone and took him various clips. Not all the time. We were out there for 2 or 3 hours, and she just did intermittent clips. And on one of them, which has been publicized and released, that I released. At one point, he says to me as we're walking through the forest, Burroughs may have been abducted, who knows? But he then goes on to say, make a statement along the lines of, they were gone for hours. That's his actual words. They were gone for hours. And it alludes to the fact that Jim Peniston and John Burroughs were missing off the air for what turns out to be hours. Now, according to John and Jim in their respective books, they liken it to 45 minutes. But Sergeant Chandler, who was one of the people on shift at the time of that first night incident, he basically says, challenges Jim Peniston later on after the incident and said, you were gone for 3 hours, disappeared. And then Holt has made that comment, which seems where he mentions hours, not minutes. So I think it's anywhere between the two, but something happened that gives rise to the fact that US Air Force security police officers were missing in the forest. So it's a question mark. But then the other time, and ironically, it involves John Burroughs again, is something that comes out that's related to Sergeant Adrian Bustinza's testimony, this key linking witness that I interviewed for 4.5 hours. And he basically was also involved on what we think is the third night, the famous Holt night, where Holt takes a small team out into the forest. They're walking around the forest to see multiple UFOs, etc. And then they come back to what's called the staging area. Now, the staging area plays an important part of the story of Rendlesham because it is it's where all the vehicles had to stop. They couldn't go any further into the forest. The forest has changed a little bit now. You could go drive a bit further now, but the staging area is still there, and that's where all the vehicles had to stop because they couldn't go any further. So it becomes a hive of activity. This is not leisurely. There's a lot of panic on, I think. It's not really ever been portrayed in the documentaries this way, but there's a real hive of activity and people, you know, looking for direction. You know, what am I doing here? And people were bewildered. Is this an exercise? Why are all these people gathering there and all these vehicles there? So it plays an important part. Well, when, according to the existing story as it stands prior to the book, Holt goes out with a small team, which ironically includes Sergeant Adrian Bastinza. He's one of five people, including Lieutenant Colonel Holt, who was that rank at the time. They're out for supposedly about 4.5 hours, and then they come back, having had their encounters, and then come back to the staging area. Now, in the staging area waiting at that time is John Burroughs. Now, John Burroughs had been off duty at the time, but something compelled him to believe that something was happening in the forest again. He lived in Ipswich. He managed to get a lift from someone back to the base, literally 7-8 miles away, back onto the base. And he was wanting to go out into the forest because he'd had this earlier encounter two nights earlier. And he'd been told, and it's actually on the Holt audio tape, people are requesting to come forward. No, keep them back, says Holt, until we... Well, when Holt does come back with his small team, and which includes Sergeant Adrian Bastinza, John Burroughs is there. John Burroughs says, can I go out back into the forest? I just want to go out myself. And Holt eventually says, okay, fair enough. And John asks Sergeant Adrian Bastinza to go back out with him into the forest. Now, he's only just come back in, and they've had some bizarre experiences, but Adrian Bastinza says, well, you shouldn't go alone, basically. I'll come out with you. And now, here's the quirk here, is they go out, and they're not in the farmer's field, but they're close to it. It's described as a walkway close, on a pathway close to the field, as best that he could remember. And he said a strange thing happened. John Burroughs is walking ahead of him, and he's behind him, a few metres behind, and he says, this is Adrian Bastinza, he says, something, it felt like something pushed me down to the ground, some force. There was nobody there, but some force pushed him to the floor. And as he fell to the floor, onto his knees and his hands, he was struck by an intense bright light, but most of the beam of light was on John, who was several metres ahead of him. And what he said to me in the interview, in the long interview I had with him, he says, as John was engulfed in this brilliant white light, he says, I could see to the left of John an outline of something. And he's referring to some kind of being of something, some kind of life form. There was something there beside John. Now, imagine looking at the sun and it's that bright and you're kind of like squinting. But he said, I could see a figure to the left of John. John was in the middle. And anybody that knows John, I think he's about 6'6". He's a big, big guy. And then on the right-hand side, there's another figure. And here's the twist. The light goes out and then they return. Now, from Adrian Bastinza's and John Burroughs' point of view, according to Adrian, they're gone for 10 minutes. But when they get back to the staging area, Holt is there and he's furious with them. You've been gone 40 minutes. Why have you been gone so long? And he's been worried about them, obviously. And it turns out for John and Adrian that they'd only felt that it was 10 minutes. But according to Holt, they've been gone for 40 minutes. So you have another missing time account, which alludes to the something happening. And of course, with the white light aspect and the figures seen on the side of John, it very much ties into that abduction stroke experiencer element was involved. So, you know, when you then now look back at this new account by James Stewart, it puts it into context. It's not unique. And as crazy as the whole incident is plausible in those terms.
Well, it's been great talking to you. And we've been talking about the book called Non-Human, The Rendlesham Forest UFO Incidents, 42 Years of Denial. And people can get that on Amazon, can't they?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon. I think in whichever country you're in, and it ships within 48 hours. Yeah, it's only available on Amazon at the moment. Who knows?
So, Pete, we've run out of time because I've got tons more questions for you. But I'll put links to the book in the show notes, and maybe you can come back in a few weeks and we'll talk more about this.
I'm open to that. I thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. I've delved in this particular show into a little in areas that I've not spoken to on other shows that I've recorded recently, but I hope you found it interesting, because there is so much stuff that most people don't know, that which you've alluded to. So I wanted to kind of a bit of extra information that they haven't heard so far.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And that was an interview with Gary Heseltine about his book, Non-Human, The Rensham Forest UFO Incident, 42 Years of Denial. And if you want to hear the rest of this interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode, which is an extra 30 minutes. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. And if you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast, it's called The Past Lives Podcast, and there are over 260 episodes. On The Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of The Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. My Instagram is The Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. It's just remarkable what you're coming up with, this new stuff. And one of the things I thought was interesting is it Jim Peniston says he used up a whole film in his camera, 36 photos?
Yes. I mean, this is widely known, but for some reason doesn't seem to register with people. He's always said that he walked around the landed craft on the first night.